sound set.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of the Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
U.S. markets rally and Asian equities fall. Unemployment rate worse, but manufacturing comes in a bit better. And our guest today, Larry Jedlow of the TIS Group and the editor of The Institutional Strategist. All this and much more on episode number 457 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Well, welcome to April. This is Andrew Horowitz. You're listening to the Disciplined Investor Podcast, where each and every week we come together to talk about finance, investments, money, all sorts of topics to hopefully get you more educated on the area of finance and investing, as well as bring you some information from some top guests. And we have a good one today, as a matter of fact, Larry Jedlow. We'll get to him in a little while. Wanted to talk about some of the things that are going on this week. First of all, just a note, DH Unplugged this week is going to be, well, on hiatus. Seems that John Dvorak is going to be celebrating a birthday. So we're not going to have a DH Unplugged this Tuesday night. So we'll talk about some things today that maybe we'll cover. We would have covered, well, possibly covered on Tuesday. So I want to talk about some of the economics that occurred last week and really just give a brief overview on some of the things that I've been looking at recently that I thought were kind of interesting. We clearly saw that the markets were in a bit of a consolidation mode for part of the week, and then by the end of the week, things turned around and went nicely higher on the unemployment report. Now, let me give you a little bit of setup of this, because what we did see overnight prior to the unemployment report on Friday, which comes out the first Friday of each and every month, was that Asian markets were not so happy. In fact, European markets were not happy either. There was some news out the night before that it was actually good in one respect. We saw that there was some better PMI or manufacturing numbers finally breaking above the 50 mark, which is expansionary in China. And you have to wonder if people are getting spooked that any kind of good number, you know, the good is bad concept, where any good number is going to be detrimental to the potential for more stimulus and more stimulative actions by the Chinese government. So that was something that was interesting. The Shanghai actually posted a zero line, as the government is very active in that market, directly investing into stocks of that particular market. And the Hong Kong Hang Seng fell about 1.5%. Now, at the same time, Japan, their currency, the yen, has been slowly but surely appreciating throughout the entire year and for some time before that. And in fact, even though we saw a very strong jobs number on Friday, generally speaking, we saw plus 200,000, and the initial claims throughout the week was good. We saw that manufacturing in the U.S., the ISM official manufacturing number, came in actually above 50, which was a surprise to the upside, which you would have thought would goose the dollar a bit. Still, the words of Fed Chairman Yellen, with the fact that there won't be a rate hike, with the potential for them putting off their concern about inflation for some time, has really put the fear into markets and particularly currency traders. And even with negative rates in Japan, negative rates in Europe, the dollar had a hard time rising significantly during even after the jobs number. Now, the yen was down, and in fact, the yen is down about 7.5% year to date. Well, I should say it differently. The yen is up. You got to look at the conversion. So the USD JPY is a downslope. So the dollar is lower. The yen is higher. The yen is strengthening, just to clarify that entirely. And that is causing a problem for their markets. As a matter of fact, the DXJ, which is the currency hedged Japanese Nikkei ETF, is now down 15% for the year to date 2016. We're actually short that position, which means that we're looking for the Nikkei to continue to moving down, and we want to do away with the currency issues that go are involved in that. So we currency hedged out and we're short the DXJ, thinking that the Nikkei is going to have continuing trouble due to the fact that Japan, even though they are talking about some further stimulus, they're talking about not only central bank-based monetary stimulus, they're talking about fiscal stimulus in the last round of discussion just last week. They're talking about pushing rates even further to the negative side in terms of deposit rates for monies that are left on deposit with the central bank. And all of this is causing an interesting situation, whereas you would think that the yen should be weakening, it's actually strengthening. What that tells you is that our central bank is stronger than their central bank. I mean, you really put it into perspective, right? If their central bank is saying they're going to continue on the path to stimulate the economy through extraordinary means of pushing the yen lower and doing what they have to do for quantitative easing, increasing the monetary base overall, and all the things that they're talking about, but they can't actually get their currency going lower, which is really interesting. It's because the dollar has reached a bit of a peak and is rolling down due to the fact that Yellen is now and gang are now talking about the fact that there's probably going to be a postponement of any rate hike for some time. And the more and more we look at this, the more it looks like that they are backed into such a corner that they just have nothing that they can do that will actually be right, except for allowing for some of their target levels to be exceeded dramatically in order to keep markets up. Because really what the central bank in the U.S. has now done is gone away from an economic standpoint at looking at how they're going to present monetary policy to simply looking at how markets react. I mean, really, if you think about it, that's really simply what they're doing. Markets don't like what's going on. Well, they'll just add stimulus, or they'll talk and really try to talk up the idea that they're not going to raise so soon, even though the unemployment rate is at their target, and now inflation can be exceeded according to them. So interesting situation there, what's going on. Manufacturing, like I said, was better in the U.S., and that is really interesting in that we saw over the last month or so some of the leaders in the markets being materials and manufacturer-related companies. The earnings season that's going to be starting in about 2 weeks is going to tell us whether or not many of these companies that have been talking about the currency headwinds over the last several months are going to come out and say, you know what, some of those headwinds have actually turned into tailwinds, because we saw that the dollar is down about 5% against the major basket of other currencies. And that being the case, while the dollar is still very strong on a basis of the last, we'll say, 3 years, the fact is that that 5% boost, we're not going to hear about it in their conference calls saying, you know what, our revenues are better, or at least the same as we expected them to be for this quarter, but we got a real benefit from currencies. You're not going to hear that, because that's going to be a negative. If they talk about how currencies have helped them so much, it would actually be a negative result, as opposed to how they talked about how currencies are a real detriment. So with that, it's going to be interesting to see, and I think the markets are going to start to get a little bit concerned about what's going to happen with earnings season if, in fact, the dollar doesn't fall much further from where we are right now. And with the U.S. markets now being at a high for 2016, in fact, if you look at the actual turnaround last quarter from the bottom to the top, from top to the bottom to the top, it was the greatest turnaround in like 50 or 60 years, I think since 1933, the biggest quarterly turnaround. Now, when I hear that, I get worried. 1933, that was not a good time, right? I mean, that wasn't a good time in markets. So does that mean this is just a dead cat bounce? It's a bear market bounce? What does this mean? I mean, right now, they're pricing that the S&P will earn in 2016 about $120+ per share. Very hard to believe that's going to be the case, which would be about an 18% increase. I'm going to ask Larry Jedlow about this a little bit more, because he has some good insight from all the things that I've read recently in his work. And I'm going to save some of that, but we'll talk about that, about whether or not that 120 is really a realistic number that we can count on. I think that there's a lot of ambitious buying that's been going on in many of the sectors right now, with the thought that oil is miraculously going to stay a lot higher. And if you looked at what happened last week, oil was down about 10%. Just when you thought things were getting better, bam, what happened? Well, just as we predicted, and we talked about it here many times, this whole idea of the production freeze that was discussed by OPEC, and that they would go along and have this freeze, which was somehow, by many people translated to a production drop, a cut on production. And that's why you saw that massive blast off of the bottom when oil was trading below 30. And it got as high as about 40. That's a big move in a very short period of time. Mind you, we did see a tremendous drop. There's no question. The drop that we've seen over the last year and a half, 2 years has been epic. So yeah, there's going to be some significant rises with any news that looks like that maybe the inventories are going to be lower, which they're not. Production dropping, which it's not. In fact, Russia just last week had the highest production report for any month they've ever had. So much for the fact that there was going to be a freeze. So they talk up this whole idea of a freeze, and then the oil runs up because people are thinking, well, yeah, a freeze means that they're going to drop their production. No, a freeze means they're not going to have any further production. Whatever their production targets are, they're not going to raise those. Once again, like I said, Russia did exceed their production targets, so they broke it. They broke the freeze. Iran came out a few weeks ago and said, you know what, I'm sorry, but did you think we were going to actually freeze? No, we're going to raise our production. Sanctions were lifted. We have nothing to say the otherwise, except for the fact that you want us to actually freeze our production. But we've been out of the market for how long? We need to make up some time. In Saudi Arabia, there was a discussion Thursday into Friday how, you know what, if Iran's not going to freeze, well, we're not going to freeze. Forget this. So now production is up. Now, production in the U.S. is down. The rig count last week dropped another 14 rigs here in the U.S. And you look at that Baker Hughes report on Fridays to find out how many rigs are either starting up or dropping off. So production is definitely dropping here. OPEC and the Middle Eastern countries are getting what they want. They wanted to choke U.S. production. So now what's happened is that they are choking it off. Production is dropping here. They're raising their production or keeping their production at the same levels. And what we have was a tremendous, about a 3.5 million. I think it was the 2.5 million or 3.5 million. It was on Wednesday. I think it was a 3 million build of approximately 3 million barrel build of oil again on top of the prior week, which was 11 million barrel build of oil. I mean, we're awash with oil. We know that. That's why prices are going back down. Are they going to collapse again back down to the low 30s? Possibly. If in fact there is no freeze or any kind of production cuts, it doesn't seem logical that the fundamentals really supported that real significant rise. And if that's the case, these companies that have had problems are going to continue to have problems. If we're going to stay below $40 and in fact start dripping down into the maybe mid 30s, you're going to start to see the whole discussion of banks having problems. You're going to see that the companies that even took in a lot of money through secondaries are going to start to have more problems because they're going to keep on eating at their cash. Their balance sheets will keep on eroding. The assets will keep on depleting. So oil is something to watch. Now, we did see that break of the oil trade on Friday where oil was down but markets were up. That was a break. Now, will that continue? Because pretty much there's been a very high correlation to the price of oil and how it's traded throughout the day and what happens with markets. Now, whether or not the rise that occurred at about 10 o'clock in the morning on Friday was due to the manufacturing report that came out and the better-than-expected consumer confidence report that came out, that's an interesting situation because, again, markets started much lower on Friday on the heels of what went on in around the world. In Asia and in Europe. Europe ended up down the day on the day, and so did Asia. But miraculously, our markets did very well. It could be because the realization was that, well, you know, the Fed, we know that they look at the unemployment rate, even though the labor participation rate actually ticked up a bit, and that was the reason why. More people entering the workforce, better work conditions, and a crazy statistical anomaly. So the unemployment rate ticked up from a 4.9 to a 5. Making it look on the surface like the unemployment is a lot worse, even though we added over 200,000 new jobs. There was a lot of construction had layoffs, and energy also had layoffs, but still a lot of part-timers coming into the fold in terms of new people on the job. But still, we saw 200,000. That's been a consistent level of employment gained on a monthly basis for some time now. But maybe markets took it as that with that number, the Fed will definitely going to push off any rate hike until, well, let's say June. Even though we heard that every meeting is going to be live. The April meeting is going to be live. So very soon we're about to get a double whammy. We're going to see what's going on with the Fed in April, and we're going to see earnings. And I'm really curious to see how earnings are going to play out and if there will be the excuse of currency or not. A couple things also to talk about. I don't know if you look at Sun Edison, that after the close on Friday, that they are looking to go into seeking bankruptcy protection now. The stock dropped another 45% after the close on Friday, down to about, I think, 30 cents. 30 cents? This stock was just 10. It was just 40. It was just 50. It was just, I mean, go back on the chart and look at this thing. This was an interesting scenario where many hedge funds were invested in this company that was earning incredible amounts of money, but what they did was consolidate a lot of other companies underneath its umbrella. And when you start seeing that kind of a situation go on where you can't really discern what's going on with the fundamentals, you have to scratch your head and wonder what's happening. And because the stock started to see that massive downstroke that it did, you had to wonder what was going on to begin with. Why was this company that everybody loved for such a long period of time all of a sudden under so much pressure? And we're going to talk about a scenario. I had a question that came in from a friend, actually a great photographer. I'm going to talk a little bit about, after we talk with our guest, a little bit about Valiant and some of the comments that she made, and we're going to go through that. But for now, let's get to a discussion with our guest. And our guest today, Larry Jedlow. He is editor of The Institutional Strategist and founder of TIS Group in Minneapolis. He's experienced in investment management with over 36 years of experience in the investment business. Been with some very major firms, responsible for some sizable assets. So I want to thank you, Larry, for joining us today.
Well, thanks for having me.
So I want to get into a discussion. We read your Institutional Strategist that you put out, and some great information there, some real good depth of the various insight that you provide. And I wanted to kind of come into this discussion talking about, we'll start with some central banks discussion. And I think that you have been pretty much on this whole target of what is the central banks really trying to do, and most recently actually talking about this whole reflationary trade. So can you kind of take us through some of this negative interest rate and the implications and what the Bank of Japan's doing in China, and how our recent central bank move has actually maybe helped that whole reflation trade?
Sure. The basic problem worldwide is we're in what we like to refer to as a Kondraty of winter, which is a naturally occurring disinflationary period. These can last for a very long time, as long as 15 or 20 years. And in our view, all the developed countries now are in the grip of this deflationary period, whether it's Japan, Europe, or the United States. The central banks are responding to this by highly unusual, if not first time ever, steps that they're taking, which we're all aware of. And maybe I can just run past each one of the different banks now that really matter, the ECB, BOG, J, Fed, and PBOC, in terms of how they're doing this. The goal is to reflate demand. Just isn't enough demand in the world right now. At the same time, prices have been falling. And in each case, there's been a sort of a dearth of, except for the PBOC now, been a dearth of fiscal spending to accompany it. So let me just start with the ECB. I'll just make some quick comments, and then we can circle back if you want to focus in on anything. ECB has adopted a negative rate structure now. They are, in their last move, just starting to do something that's also quite different. They're paying banks now, or they will be paying banks, to loan money. So this would be the ECB paying commercial banks in Europe to lend to customers that we don't think that they really have. There isn't much demand for loans right now in Europe. So what they're doing is, in our view, going to force the yield curve even more negative on the short end. And this is creating enormous problems in the insurance market and for pension funds, who are now trying to invest with no possibility of a positive return. And so, in fact, their liabilities are rising infinitely. And for that reason, we think that the ECB has embarked on something that is actually a policy that's actually quite dangerous. And they need to have it accompanied by a fiscal push, but they're not getting it. They're not getting any help at all from the from governments across Europe. In fact, it's the other way around. The Germans in particular have been pushing austerity for years. The BOJ also just adopted negative rates in January, negative rate approach, and the governor of the Bank of Japan there, Kuroda, very quickly went from pushing rates to deposits to a negative 10 bips. He's already talking about going to a negative 50 bips. And this would be a deeper level than the ECB, which is targeting about a negative 40 bips now. The Bank of Japan here is also started on a path that is quite unusual, in that while the ECB has been buying assets like corporate debt, they're starting to buy corporate bonds now, primarily German and French bonds, because that's what's available. The BOJ, on the other hand, has been buying stock ETFs, large blocks of stock ETFs. And in a new move, one of the things they've just started to do is make purchases of ETFs which target specific kinds of companies. So now they're actually tailoring the kind of ETFs that they're willing to buy to how companies manage their businesses. So they're looking for companies, for instance, that are giving wage raises or providing daycare for workers. This is completely new. This is like central banking with semi-organized socialist policies attached to it. The PBOC, third bank that we think is important, is off on a different track entirely. They're cutting rates, but they're not negative. They're not anywhere close to being negative. And we think that over the course of the rest of the year, there'll be more rate cuts in the PBOC, but there's also a fiscal spend now that's coming in China. There's a very large fiscal spend that's unfolding here, and they are targeting investment in commodities, in companies, like the Bank of Japan, but companies across the world that solve some of China's most pressing problems, and one of them we think is food pollution. Their purchase a couple years ago, Smithfield Foods in the U.S., was the world's largest pork producer, an example of that. And then Syngenta, which they just bid for this year, which is a major global seed company, is another example. And we think there'll be more of that. So this is quite a different approach than, let's hop to the Fed for the moment, which is the only major central bank, which is even, I think, really pondered hiking rates this year. The PBOC is in full-out reflation mode now. So if you think about the first three banks I named here, ECB, BOJ, PBOC, they're all in reflation mode. The one that sticks out is the Fed, which is started the year saying that they'd possibly have four rate hikes on the table. Now they're down to two. And we think they've reached a crossroads now at the Fed. The crossroads is that if you look at core CPI in the U.S., it touched 2.2% about a month ago. It's now at 1.7%. And it's doing so without really too much help from the commodity markets. Everything is going up. Not everything, but most categories are going up now, from rents to home prices to car prices to healthcare costs in particular. And now they have, they have something else to deal with on the inflation front, and that is we think that commodity markets may have bottomed. So if you do get commodity markets led by oil moving higher, we're going to have an inflation spike in the U.S. And so I think the crossroads they're at is they've made the choice. I think I want to make that clear. We think they've made the choice. This should have given them enough ammunition to hike rates. In fact, what we think they've chosen to do instead is accommodate the inflation and try and help relieve stress that's in the financial system. And you can see those stress indices, for instance, in all the regional Feds, which are spiking. And that, we think, is the reason why Mrs. Yellen has backed off as fast as she has on four hikes to two hikes. And by the end of the year, we think all the major central banks in the world will, in fact, be reflating, including the Fed. So we think the Fed is very cognizant here of stock prices. We think they want a lower dollar. We don't think they're putting as much emphasis on economic data points as they have been, perhaps have been suggesting. And if you look at the Atlanta GDP Now calculation, which we like to watch, it's down to a plus 0.6% now. It's literally collapsed in the last month. So where the case is for a rate hike other than the inflation spike, which I'm quite sure they will argue is transitory, is we don't see it.
You know, it's interesting that, how about this for a big picture, that essentially the PBOC and the Bank of Japan and the ECB have all been involved in this whole, you know, for the last 8 years or so, this reflation trade, very cognizant, as you mentioned, of the markets and this whole wealth effect and all that. And now looking to possibly, and very clearly from what Yellen said, pretty much throwing out some of their targets as, well, you know what, we'll see how that goes, but we're willing to accept a little bit more on the outside, which has been a consistent, listen, they've dropped their target rate from 6 to 5.5 to 5 on the unemployment rate, right, over time. Mm-hmm. So how about this as an idea, that maybe the problem is that they should be focusing on economic output of or economic returns with regard to their various policy rather than markets, and maybe we wouldn't be in this deflationary spiral because something's not going right. You would think that 8 years after the entire world almost imploded and there was an incredible amount of backfilling into the holes that were created by this, you know, like giant meteors came down and the Fed had to kind of fill in the hole first and then get everything moving back in the other direction. Something's not right with policy, and then maybe is it possible that policy can't do what they think it can?
Well, we agree that monetary policy is not sufficient by itself here to reflate the global economy, particularly in developed markets. So what we think they're doing by focusing on stock prices and to a lesser extent currencies and financial markets generally, is what they're basically trying to do is save the banking system. That's the real risk, as it was 8 years ago. So they're still fighting the last war, which you know central banks have been known to do from time to time.
Right.
And it's a fear that's not unfounded, but if they had growth, if there was real economic growth of the kind that we had in the 1980s, countries could grow their way out of these problems and the banking systems would be a lot healthier. They'd have demand for loans. They'd have wider spreads. They'd have more profits. But instead, it's like the financial system is on life support here and the juice just keeps being pushed into the system. We think out of concern that if there's another implosion, as there was in 2008, 2009, that the next one could be worse. So
I guess what really kind of I keep on coming back to in this, and I do a lot of work in this, and I try to understand what's going on. You know, what is the root cause of this? I mean, I've kind of gone to, well, is it possible that this new generation with technology that, and there's all sorts of technology, of course, but with technology which has benefited a lot of companies and created a lot of wealth. I mean, listen, we went from companies with market caps of 100 million to multiple billions in like a blink of an eye. You know, the extra uh-huh. the extra zero on everything or extra three zeros was put on, you know, spending. Mm-hmm. I remember when, who was it? Was it Ford? No. It was Bush. Bush came out, remember he came out with a $200 million stimulus package and everybody was like, that's fantastic. You remember that?
Mm-hmm.
And now it's like, we'd look at that, go, how far is that? That's going to get you 2 days. It's not going to get you anywhere. So I think that maybe this whole idea of technology, the way we spend, the way we buy, the way we act, what we do, we're not out there doing things like we've done before that is more related to manual, quote unquote, manual labor or any kind of, we don't have to travel as much because we can, you know, talk on a FaceTime to somebody. I think I agree with you that there's going to be a very hard road ahead of us. And the big question is that, I guess in all of this, how is it that the rest of the world seems to be failing so miserably and having such a difficult time where the U.S. seems to be doing much better? How is that happening?
Well, I think the two best examples that you're pointing to are Europe and Japan,
mm-hmm.
Which are having just dreadful economic patches here relative to the U.S., which is not going great guns either. Growing, 1.5-2% a year we haven't had a 3% growth here in 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
But, Japan in particular, after years of above average growth, looks to us like it. I don't want to say they're not in depression, but they're perilously close to recession almost all the time now.
Yeah.
And yet they're contemplating a tax hike next April, which in Japanese history has been, you can bet on it. They will have a recession following that tax hike, and yet they seem bound and determined to do so. So it's bad policy. I think that's part of it. The other part of it, I think, is just regulation. If you go to you go to the EU now and try to start a business and you try to fight your way through the red tape, it's enormous. And they've built up these huge welfare states, which are sucking all the capital in from tax revenues, which are significant, but they're not put to as productive a use as it might be in starting small businesses, for instance, right. Which is very, very difficult to do in both those areas. So it's kind of a combination of policies that don't work, aging populations, demographics does not play a small role in this, by the way. This is an enormous issue now for Japan going forward, and it will be for Europe as well, and for Russia, although not counting Russia as part of Europe. These are countries that are going to have a completely different fiscal need to fulfill to their citizens, which they've been doing out of the bond markets for years, and that may no longer be possible without the kind of tax hikes that I don't think people are even contemplating now, and that's off already very high tax rates. Mm. So it's just going to be extremely difficult, we think, for these countries to grow. Now, we're not immune from this in the U.S. We're sort of heading down the same road, but we have some advantages in that we have a lot of natural resources. We have very good technology. We have a completely different demographic situation. It's not great, but it's better than those two other areas. And I think we have more flexible policy as well, although I noticed even Mr. Bernanke said the other day that monetary policy is approaching sort of the end of its ability to, operate as efficiently as it used to.
Right.
So we do need some new approaches.
Well, we have possibly a few coming in, or at least a choice of a few coming in with the presidential election cycle right now in its process. I know you've had some interesting work that you did on this. Now we have, who knows who's going to get in, if there's going to be a contested, contest in the Republican side. I mean, who knows what's going to happen here, but I think that you had talked about that the potential for infrastructure development with a new president coming in, at least as a platform, which seems to be what Obama has. Listen, President Obama has not stopped talking about infrastructure and bridges since he got in. Education, infrastructure, healthcare, and bridges. Right. I mean, that every speech starts or ends with that. You think that's going to continue on no matter who comes in?
Well, I think that's one potential solution. We certainly need infrastructure spending on a large scale. And what I've been looking for is somebody to propose sort of a Manhattan-type project for U.S. infrastructure, whether it's roads, bridges, internet infrastructure, a technology that protects our electronics systems from EMP attacks, or, just the entire electronic digital system. We need to spend the money on that. And it would create a lot of jobs, and I think there'd be a lot of political support for it. I'm just sort of surprised that there hasn't been a stronger push up to this point. So my guess is that when the election, by the way, I have no idea. It's too opaque here. I can't tell you who's going to end up running.
I hear you. Probably one of the most bizarre election cycles that I've seen in my lifetime.
Very exciting.
Yeah.
and entertaining.
Yep. It is that. When you say Manhattan Project, you're talking about the Manhattan Project back in World War II?
Yeah, exactly. The project that we ran to develop nuclear technology and eventually build a bomb. I'm not saying build another bomb.
No, I hear you.
The resources that were put in place were enormous.
Yeah, as a side note, my grandfather was involved in that and worked with Einstein on one of the timing devices. So I got some good stories about that. It's pretty cool.
You should tell them someday.
Yeah, no, they're interesting. I did. What I did? I thought this was kind of neat. You know, he passed away a few years ago, but before he passed, he was still a very lively gent. Put a couple of cameras on him, and I made a whole biography of his life with him during the discussion. So we have it for all history. It's on YouTube, actually. So in terms of this presidential cycle, though, that you have done some work, and I know that anytime, it seems to me at least, anytime we identify a cycle that happens on a regular basis, the next time it doesn't seem to happen. But you had looked at past cycles where there was a two-term president and then a new president coming in, and then the after effects of that were just not very good.
Yeah, that's correct.
For markets.
And generally, the market will start down prior to the election. So we usually have a weak S&P starting around summertime or fall going into election, and then for some period of time afterwards, as long as a year and a half. And this wouldn't surprise me. And the reason for that is especially if you get a regime change. So, for instance, if you go from a Democratic president and his policies and his areas of emphasis for the economy to a Republican or vice versa. You know, and the thing this time, I think, is good to look at this point, to look at it early, is what were to happen if, you know, I just look back at the last 8 years, if there's any one sector of the economy and the market that benefited during the Obama years, it was healthcare. Mm-hmm. It was the passage of Obamacare and the build-out of that whole system. You look at some of the best-performing stocks in the last 6 years, they've been healthcare names.
Right.
Of many types. If that were to be changed at all now, and let's say that some of the resources that have been poured into Obamacare were shifted over to infrastructure spending, you'd have an enormous shift in market cap for the S&P away from some very large market cap companies like the drug stocks, for instance, perhaps, and into basic materials companies or companies like Fluor, which I mentioned the other day, mm-hmm. that do benefit from spending on construction and infrastructure. And I think that's not at all impossible here. Now, I think it's actually a pretty good chance this happens, because when I think who can win right now, as I said, I have no idea who's going to win. But I think there's enough support for the idea here that's emerging that the Fed can't do it all, and there'll be a consensus developed that we need to do more, that some kind of fiscal spending program does need to be done. And it won't be a bailout kind of spending program like we had in late 08 and 09 when we were doing shovel-ready jobs that actually turned out to be not very shovel-ready.
Mm-hmm.
This could be much more strategic and much more targeted, and I think we probably have quite broad support. And I don't think it really matters whether it's a Republican or a Democrat who proposes this. So I think there's a good chance that happens. And so, in fact, I'm picking on healthcare here, but we think healthcare may have topped.
Well, I mean, the bottom line is that from the list of people that could possibly get in and are currently on the platform to make it all the way to the next president, I don't think any of them have a love affair with healthcare at all. And as a matter of fact, each one of them right? I mean, they've really. We had the Twitter, the infamous Twitter post, and the whole thing with Marty Schreckle. And we've had all the things that have gone on here, but it looks like, I mean, and the Republicans get in, they want to dismantle, not that they may be able to, but dismantle Obamacare. And if the Democrats get in, whether it's Sanders, who's a socialist and as per his own Democrat, but a socialist style, there may be some major changes. And if Hillary Clinton comes in, I mean, she looks like she's going to attack the biotech and the pharmaceuticals hand over fist.
On pricing. Yeah,
yep.
Exactly.
So,
yeah. And if Trump were to get in, I think he mentioned the other day that he would be interested in allowing insurance to be sold across state lines. Well, if that happens, you could have insurance premiums coming down like a shot, which means that would run right back into reimbursement rates, right back to the companies. I mean, it could be a huge shakeup there. And that's not bullish.
By the way, a one-payer system, I don't know what you, just a side note, I'm thinking of this, but a one-payer, single-payer system, it just seems to me that why do we go through this whole rigmarole with setting all this up with the states and all that stuff as it was when we had the whole infrastructure maybe needed to be redesigned, et cetera, but we had the whole Medicare structure already set up for universal health care. It seemed like that would be the way to go. Not that I'm totally in favor of the government doing the insurance deal, but I'm just saying it seemed like a much easier process.
Well, we didn't do it easily, did we?
No,
we
definitely
did it the hard
not.
Way.
No, definitely not. Let me just finish up on this. You have some pretty, now at the beginning of this year, you were pretty negative on markets and you were very concerned about a variety of things. And you do this from a very, kind of a bird's eye view, looking at economic conditions and central bank issues, as well as currencies, all the different things that go into this. Now, one of the things that has me concerned is that, while, yes, we did see some of these things happen and there may be some opportunities, as we've seen from the bounce on the bottom where the Fed cowered and got, very nervous and started to make some discussion that maybe it's not going to be this. And we saw that negative interest rates pushed in Europe and negative interest rates pushed in Japan, and the reserve requirement rate in China obviously was dropped, and all these different things that went on, not to mention China actively involved in their markets. But you had some pretty real concerning concerns about the markets in U.S. In the beginning of this year. Then you turn around a little bit and you're kind of like, okay, things are a little bit better. But still, concerned about the third and fourth quarter and looking at possibly a drop down. Is earnings in your discussion here? Because we're still expecting a 10% increase in earnings this coming quarter or for this coming year, which I don't know how that's, or 10 to 12% increase in earnings. I don't know how that's possible, except for the fact that maybe we have a little bit of a tailwind due to the currency issue. And but is that really something that's going to play out, or are people just totally fooling themselves at this point?
Well, we think earnings estimates are too high. I think they're up around $122
yeah.
or something like that.
Which means about
$5 for the S&P.
Which is a 16% increase from where we are closed last year.
Yeah, and we think that's too high. So that number will come down, which means that the real problem, I think, is valuations. The valuation on the S&P looks like it's around 16 times, 17 times.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the fundamental beliefs we have now is that it's really the credit markets that drive the stock markets. And the credit markets, the spreads have blown out over the last 3 months, and they're not coming back in very much, which is that this is a warning shot for the for the equity market. And right now, if you look at, for instance, the BarCap High Yield Index relative to the 10-year Treasury, the PE on the S&P should be 12, roughly 12, to 10 to 12 times. It's not. It's 17 times. So if spreads were to begin to rise again, to blow out for any reason, we think the PE is going to have to come down. So, you know, if you come, you can just do the math. If even if we hit $122, let's use $120, it's an even number. Let's say you hit $120 this year times 12. That's an S&P at 1440, not 2040. Yeah. And that's where we are, is 2040 or 2050 or 2060. We're about 30% too high, we think, in terms of where the multiple should be. And our guess is that it's not $122, $123, $124 that the S&P will come in at this year. It'll come in sort of around between $115 to $120. The estimates are going to come down. So that's one problem. The bigger problem, though, we think is it's partly the election, but really think it's going to come from offshore, outside the U.S. The last two bubbles that have popped have been U.S. centric. They've been the dot-com bubble. If you want to blame anybody, it was us,
mm-hmm.
it was our market. And then it was housing, U.S. housing in 07, 08. This time we think it's going to come from outside the states. And if you look around the world, there's not a shortage of candidates here, but just I'd point out two of them in particular. One is the way the bank stocks are acting in Europe. They look horrible.
Yep.
The charts look awful. Mm-hmm. They're signaling that there's something wrong in these big universal especially banks, especially the investment bank. In fact, there's a front page article on the FT today about how trading revenues at these banks have slowed down significantly. And as a result, is they're cutting jobs as fast as they can. That's, if that backs up into the financial system, that will affect us in the U.S. We're not immune from this. That's one area. The second area is what we think is going on in Japan, and that is, we have a theory that the marginal supplier of liquidity in the world is Japan. So when Japan goes into recession, which I just discussed a little bit in terms of the rate hike that's coming, or investors in Japan begin to anticipate they're going in recession, they pull money back. They tend to pull money back home. They need it. And when they do that, the yen starts to rise. And when the yen starts to rise, the Nikkei falls, and you get a lot of covering in the financial markets globally because the yen is used as a funding currency. If that happens now, and it has been, it started already, the yen dollar is already starting to rise, there's a very good correlation if you just look at the Nikkei. So the Nikkei tends to top about 3 to 6 months before the S&P does, and we've seen this happen a couple of times now in both the dot-com and the housing bubble that I described. Now, the Nikkei has now topped about 5 to 6 months ago in this cycle, and yet the S&P has not come down yet.
Mm-hmm.
So the other outside the U.S. risk that we're watching very carefully here is, it smacks of desperation to me that Kuroda is already talking, DOJ governor is talking about going even more negative with rates just 2 months after he went negative in the first place.
Which is, by the way, just so everybody knows, he said on one day, we're not going to go negative. 1 week later, they went negative, right? Tell me, right,
yes.
1 week later. A few days after that said, we're not going to do any further negative rate moves. And then like a couple of weeks after that, they're already starting to hum around that they may do further. That's pretty much the timeline, right?
That's exactly right. He went. He actually was sitting in front of the parliament, the Japanese Diet, the first time, and said, "We're not doing it." And a week later, he does it. So something's not right there. Something's wrong. And the yen started to rally almost immediately at that point.
Mm-hmm.
So negative rates. It's interesting, both in Europe and Japan, as rates have gone more, the currencies have started rising.
Yeah, that's weird.
Yeah,
very weird. And by the way, the interesting thing is, if anybody wants to just do this and have a chart of S&P futures next, let's say a 10-minute chart or a 5-minute chart of S&P futures next to a similar time frame, 5-minute chart of the yen cross of the dollar, they're almost identical, tick by tick.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, I think there's a lot of something to be said about that, that Japan clearly is. And, you know, we know as we get closer and closer to the open of the Japanese markets and right on the Japanese market, the yen starts to, you know, kind of come down as we start to see things move up in the Japanese. It's kind of like comical almost how it happens. But anyway, we're out of time here. I could talk to you all day. Fabulous information. How can people find out more about some of the things? I know it's mostly institutional, but how can people get more information about some of the products that you offer?
Well, you can go to our website, which is TIS Group, and I believe there's an icon there that talks about sales or say product information. They can click on that, and somebody will be in touch.
All right, so I'll make sure to put all that information on the show notes from this this episode, and this is great stuff, and I enjoy reading it. So Larry Jedlow, I appreciate it, from the TIS Group and writing The Institutional Strategist, a wealth of information and really a lot to think about. I appreciate you coming on.
Well, thanks for having me.
Well, there's one smart guy for you, huh? Larry Jedlow from the Institutional Strategist of TIS Group. TIS Group is the company. Institutional Strategist is the newsletter that he writes. So make sure to get your hands on that because that's some pretty good stuff there. Before we went to the our discussion with our guest, I had mentioned that I wanted to talk to you about Tesla, but I wanted to kind of was talking about this whole SunEdison issue. This is kind of talk about Tesla for a second here. Interesting that this new car that was announced last week by Tesla, the $35,000 deal, and Elon Musk, the inventor, the chairman, president of Tesla, I guess they collected about 200,000 deposits of about $1,000 each. It's kind of interesting because they're in production right now of 55,000 cars or so a year. Obviously, they have the Gigafactory, which is going to be used to mass produce these cars. Pretty cool little car. A lot of the same features as the $100,000 or so car that they have, the Tesla, various models of sportier ones. This one's a little bit small. I think they put it on par with the size of a BMW 3 Series or a C Series Mercedes class. Very interesting. The big question is, and I have to research this because I think there's somewhere in the neighborhood of about a $7,000 tax credit that you get for buying a electric car, a fully electric car. And I wonder if you get that for this car being much lower in cost than the other. Because if you do, you really think about that. A $7,000 tax credit, which is a direct credit against your taxes. So you owe $10,000, you get a $7,000 credit, just now you only owe $3,000. It's not a deduction, it's a credit. And if that's the case, this makes this highly affordable for almost anybody. It pretty much wipes off an income of about $40,000+ of excess income above the tax base. So, you know, if you're in a 30% tax bracket or so, $30,000, you know, you take off some basic deductions, et cetera, and now you get the but down to, you know, about $7,000-$8,000 in taxes, and you just whack it right off with this credit. That is pretty cool, and I think that that's going to really be very beneficial for the company. There's still some glitches. They talked about how they don't have enough power stations, and obviously it does about 215 miles approximately per charge. Car's a little bit smaller. The screen that had the various control panels a little bit smaller, but still very nice in a little bit of a different location. It's a four-door from the one I saw. I don't know if they have a coupe version also, but at least kind of nice looking with the whole total sunroof. Just a very lovely car, really. Nothing wrong with it. Question is whether or not Tesla's numbers are going to play out in terms of a recent upgrade. We saw that now there's someone, one of the major firms, having a price target next year of $500. Kind of interesting. There's a real lot of negativity going into this of whether or not it's going to be something good. But 200,000 deposits. Now, the deposits are fully refundable, by the way. So that's not necessarily meaning that there's going to be that many cars necessarily sold. Or I could also say that a lot more people may come in with deposits as well. So Tesla has some money to work with. There's no question about that. They've always had a decent balance sheet in terms of that. The price multiple was a little bit out of whack, but maybe they're growing into it. That could be interesting. Question is, how is this going to hurt the future of potential, I mean, this low-cost, fully electric car, the potential for oil prices that we were talking about before. Now you have a demand issue, a further demand issue. How is this also going to hurt car companies? We saw that the total car sold, the report that came out on Friday, was significantly lower than anticipated by about a few hundred thousand cars on an annualized basis. I think it was actually about 450,000 cars on the lower side of what estimates were. Now, what's interesting about that is that we did see that peak come out, and there I had talked about, and I've talked about several times on this show and on DH Unplugged, how I do wonder if the car companies were pulling a lot of their forward sales into current sales with a lot of the discounts and incentives they were giving, and more importantly, the low cost and extended financing that they were providing for people in the 7-year average. And I think that we see that now the subprime loans that are done on automobiles are at their highest level in decades in terms of delinquency rates. And you have to wonder if they did a lot of pull through. This happens sometimes in industries. It happened clearly in the housing market. That was the whole point, right? That there was a lot of pull through of sales back in 2004, 2005, when refinancings were big, where there was 100% availability of financing with no money down. All these crazy loans that were going on, the adjustable rate loans, a lot more money people had. Prices were going up very nicely. Difference on a car is prices don't go up. They deteriorate as soon as you walk out of the showroom with it. A little bit of a different scenario, but still a big similarity when it comes to the pull-through. So Tesla, kind of interesting. I was actually very happy to see that they had such an incredible amount of people waiting in line to give the deposits, and it went over so well because it's a beautiful car. There's no question about it. Let's talk a little bit just for a moment. There is someone I know who actually did some work for some voiceovers, great photographer. Her name is Lisa. And Lisa wrote a little post that I read about her experience with investing. And it went something like this. That she decided that with all of her work that she did, she wanted to get involved in investing a few years ago. And she did this a little bit of tongue in cheek. She spent all day, one whole day, investing everything she needed to know about investing. This is what she wrote in a blog post. And in that day, she kind of discovered a variety of things, figured out how to deal with opening a brokerage, dealing with all the different things about some things about technical analysis and understanding about a stock and things of that nature. And then she fast forward and she told a story about how she bought Valeant Pharmaceuticals, VRX was the symbol, and did really well, turned an immediate position into about a 40% gain. And then fast forward a little bit further, here we are. Now she's holding on to about a 70 or 80% loss on the security. So just a quick lesson. I'm going to give her a call and talk to her a little bit about this, but just something I want to kind of square with this. Where'd she go wrong? Now, I don't have the details about this, but obviously one of the things that happened is she got the idea that investing was really easy. You just buy something, it goes up. You don't have to do anything about it. Now, that may be something to consider if you have a stock that is not a Valeant. It's not a Sun Edison. It's not, you know, these oil stocks right now that are fast-growing drillers that just petered out due to the fact that there was a reliance on something other than their own production. And there was outside forces that were really pressing on them beyond just the product that they had. But obviously she didn't have any sell stops put in on it. And if it was a big position of hers, it's something that you need to work on. You need to have some sell stops if it is a position that is a trading position. Now, we have certain stocks in our portfolios that we don't have stops on. We don't have traditional stops on. We have time-based stops because we have a fundamental underpinning, but they're very small positions in the portfolio that entirely all the positions that we have in this one component add up to a full allocation for equities, let's say. But we're not talking about that. We're talking about a position that she had that was worthwhile, let's say, or as an example, a position that's worthwhile, and you have a target for it, and if for whatever reason that target is met, you need to sell it and take some of your profits off the table. And the mistake that was made was that once she got back down to the level where she bought it, she didn't see clear enough for whatever reason that there was something wrong, something going on. And that's very easy to understand. Think about the times that you've had a stock and you buy it for $50, stock goes up to 70, let's just say, and it starts backtracking because maybe the markets, generally speaking, or the sector, something's just not right. You know, markets are coming down. So you're saying, I'm willing as a good stock. I'm willing to run with it and ride the various waves of the ups and downs of the market and of this situation is just caught up in it. And that's okay. We'll kind of just let that thing go. And when the markets turn around back again to the upside, which they will eventually for a little while or for a long period of time, this stock will once again be on top of its game. The problem was that there was a lot of clues with Valiant as a good example that something was just not right. First of all, the massive defense that Ackman put on the stock, that 4 or 5 hour sweat phone call that he did that was really panic driven because the amount of money that he was losing on it, and the fact that he went in such a big way with more positioning and options, selling puts and buying calls, all the things that were going on with that, was very much something that should have been an alarm, an alert that went off. The second thing was when when Hillary Clinton came out and directly or basically pointed a finger at these kind of firms that were doing pharmaceutical sales, biotechnology-related products that only would buy companies then hike the prices up so dramatically. In an environment where we have a very high level of political campaigning going on and trying to appeal to the masses and particularly hit every characteristic of someone's hot point or hot button where they could find, yeah, I'm paying a lot for pharmaceuticals, man, I don't want that going on anymore. So you know what? I'm going to vote for her because she is really going to do something about that and help my personal situation. So you have politics at play. That's not a good thing. And then what you have is a deterioration of the stock price that keeps on moving lower. So you have two things now. First was Hillary Clinton clearly tweeting out and the whole Martin Shkreli situation with his company going bankrupt and now him being under arrest or something going on with him with a lawsuit and criminal actions against him. You have the entire slate of candidates pretty much pointing a finger at pharmaceutical practices and biotechs, and now they're being called into Congress. That's just not a good environment. It may not be every company, and it is not every company, but there are a few that really profited from this. The second thing, the third thing you had was the hedge funds that were involved in this, the massive amount of hedge funds that you knew that if in fact something went wrong, they were going to run for the hills and just crater the stock. On top of that, the next clue you had was that somehow, miraculously, this Pearson, who was the biggest advocate, the president and CEO of the company, who went on this mysterious 2-month pneumonia time off, that was not a good thing. Then when he comes back, he postpones the earnings. Now, this is more recent after the stock already is down 50%. Comes back and pushes off earnings. Then they come out with earnings that are terrible, outlook that's awful, still concerning things about Philidor not really getting a handle on what's going on with what's happening with that they closed down, which was another tip-off. And then finally, when he is asked to leave, the biggest advocate is now, which, by the way, Ackman, the biggest hedge fund advocate, who is the biggest advocate of Michael Pearson, the CEO, now has to step down, is forcibly removed basically from his seat and office at Valiant. I mean, just all these things just kind of, now what do you do? I mean, now what? Is the company going to go the way of like a SunEdison? Because really, we don't really understand what is going on with the company itself and how they are put together and how the company is actually running and what is going to be the next catalyst if they can't raise rates and buy companies and find a drug that's, you know, maybe $1 per dose and they're going to boost it to $3, $4, $5, and that's how they're going to make their revenue growth that they've been seeing for many, many years. So this is a major problem here. They're not going to all of a sudden start an R&D division. Again, this is one scenario, but you can take this and look at it in other stocks and find out where the canary in the coal mine was with regard to all the different things that were related here. You know, you see these things mount up, and if you just write them down and you say, hey, stock is coming in, there's heavy volume on the downside, there's this clue, that clue, this clue. Maybe you want to say that 10% below your buy-in price is a point when you should have actually thought about getting out. You could have used some technicals, of course. Fundamentals maybe wouldn't have shown you anything because they're a little bit in arrears. And obviously, this really was a situation where the stock went from 280 down to wherever it is now, 27, in a pretty significant line. There was so many times you could have gotten out, but at the same time, what it probably ended up happening in this scenario was that, you know, how you use that very frightening and harmful saying, how much worse can it get? And I hope that things will get better. Those two things never seem to work out well. There's all sorts of other things like, you know, catching a falling knife or holding onto a falling knife, or, you know, but if you would have used some basic strategy to put a sell stop in or to put a target price in that you're willing to take this down to, it's an investment. And probably, Lisa, I'm going to say that the one day of work you did and understanding everything there was to understand about investing probably wasn't enough. And it just so happened you got a lucky start to the whole process. And maybe one of the problems was that you didn't see an opportunity to take some of the profits off the table. What did you think was going to happen? The stock was going to be a 10-timer, let's say. Now, I'm not coming down on Lisa herself. It's just an example. Just a quick lesson for everybody. It's a lesson because I think it's a good lesson to understand. But if you're going to be investing in a stock and there are some basic principles, fundamentals, technicals, whatever it is that you're using to get into that stock and things change, that is a reason to get out. If things change to the negative, things change to the positive. If all of a sudden, for example, we'll give another example. Let's say that we have some of these oil companies that have been just absolutely obliterated. And fundamentally, we know that the big problem is that oil is under $30 or under $40. And companies are not going to be able to continue to perform and not going to continue to stay in existence if that's the case. But all of a sudden, fundamentals change. Maybe there's a tax code change. Maybe there's a change in the balance sheet, like we saw the secondaries. Maybe that oil is going to go, is at $50. If there's a fundamental change, that's fine to the positive of something that was a very big negative before. If, for example, we see in the copper area that all of a sudden copper prices come up dramatically and there's a lot more copper consumption, or copper demand is higher, or on the other hand, production is lower, something that's going to benefit the copper business, well, maybe Freeport will do a lot better. But now that we're seeing that Freeport really has seen this massive move to the upside without a lot of fundamental underpinnings at this point, even though we just had this discussion with Larry that maybe that China is going to be turned back to be a consumer again and back into consumption and buying up some of these kinds of commodities again, which is a little bit hard to believe. Maybe that's a change in fundamentals that you want to look at. But when you have a fundamental change to the negative and prices are following, it's time to put in some stops and to say, you know what, here's my line in the sand. That's where I'm getting out. Anyway, a little bit long-winded, but something you need to think about. It's really easy in hindsight to look at this, of course. During when it's happening in real time, very difficult. However, if you have a piece of paper or a chalkboard or a whiteboard or maybe a notes in your phone, and you start writing down some of the things that are going on that are changing, and as they start to add up, you notice, wait, there's a trend. Something's not right here. Maybe that's time to start to think about maybe looking for the exit. Anyway, again, Lisa, I'm not picking on you, but just a quick lesson I thought was really good to bring to the show this week to talk about so everybody can learn from this. Anyway, listen, if you want to contact me, go over to thedisciplinedinvestor.com. There's information on the various strategies that we manage, as well as how to contact me. AskAndrew@thedisciplinedinvestor.com is the email. Follow me on Twitter. Please do me a favor. Let's boost those Twitter numbers. Follow me on Twitter. By the way, Twitter's getting pretty interesting. We just added a piece, very small piece of a long on Twitter. There are some things that are becoming very interesting on Twitter that I think will attract some more users. We're not going to go headfirst into this deal because we know there's a lot of problems. But right now, it looks like it's basing out here. The opportunity for some upside is there with a little bit of a surprise. Anything goes right with Twitter, anything. And it's going to be a major win. We know that other companies are eating their lunch, but I got to tell you, if they just do a few things right, that there maybe is an opportunity here. Hopefully this is not a discussion like people have been having for the last 5 years on Yahoo, but nonetheless. Anyway, thanks for joining me. We'll see you again next week. Don't forget that Closer to the Pin over on DH Unplugged is open and ready to go. Each and every week we find a new stock that you can then put in a price guess on what you think it will be the following couple of weeks later. and the closest to the pin or close to the price actually wins, and we'll announce it, give you a t-shirt or maybe a book or something. We'll find something for you. Some great prizes and giveaways on that over on DH Unplugged. Make sure to listen to that each and every week. I think you'll get a real, real hoot out of some of the topics we discussed there. Thanks for listening. We'll talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
Investor Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contains forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor, regulated in various states. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.